Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Department of Modern Languages and Comparative Literature and the College of Arts and Sciences. Our speaker is Iraqi-born novelist and literary translator Sinan Antoun. Professor Antoun's lecture is titled Translation and the Work of Mourning. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Department of Modern Languages and Comparative Literature Assistant Professor Margaret Litvin.
I am honored and excited to introduce today's guest of the Literary Translation Seminar, the Iraqi-born novelist, literary translator, scholar, critic, documentary filmmaker, and public intellectual Sinan Antoun. Translation, like poetry itself, of course, as we know, is usually a precarious business, some kind of act of love across a cultural or historical as well as a linguistic divide. Sinan's position has been more in between and precarious than many. Born in Baghdad in 1967, he attended college there before arriving in the United States for graduate school, first at Georgetown and then at Harvard, where he earned a PhD in Arabic literature. He now teaches at the Gallatin School at NYU, focusing on both pre-modern and modern Arabic literature and contemporary Arab culture and politics. His scholarly works include the very newly released Politics of the Obscene, Ibn al-Hajjaj and Suf, and numerous essays on the poetry of Mahmoud Darwish, Sargun Bulus, and contemporary Iraqi culture. He's also extremely active in the Arabic press as well as in American publications, including the New York Times, Al Jazeera, The Nation, Middle East Report, Journal of Palestine Studies, Journal of Arabic Literature, The Massachusetts Review, World Literature Today, Plowshares, and Washington Square Journal. You can hear in the variety of these interests an in-between and back and forth between intellectual life in the literary sense, and politics in the contemporary sense, and sort of current events, public interest publications, and literary publications. Sinan has been eloquent about the forensic, as he called it, interest, what I tend to call ethnographic interest, with which Western audiences, even literary-minded audiences like ours today, frankly, sometimes approach literature from and about the Arab world. In 2010, he said, "I don't want to be the native informant. There's increased interest in the Arab world, but I call it forensic interest. For the most part, it's bad because it's assumed that novels and poems are going to explain September 11th to you. For example, I got a phone call from someone who says, 'I want you to speak about agriculture in Iraq.' I was like, 'Why would I know anything about agriculture in Iraq?' But it's assumed," you can see the Orientalist structures replicating themselves here, "it's assumed that as an Oriental subject, I would just know everything about my culture and civilization." And for a novelist, for a poet, to face and respond to that kind of audience, among other kinds of audiences, is a permanent pressure. Sinan's three novels confront this problem head on, delivering different doses of pleasure and information for their different audiences. His first novel, Ejam, an Iraqi Rhapsody, which came out from City Lights in San Francisco in 2007, appeared in German, Portuguese, Norwegian, and Italian editions too, as well as this beautiful collaborative translation by Sinan and then graduate student Rebecca Carroll Johnson. It's heartbreakingly informative, it is, and imaginative, about life in Saddam Hussein's Iraq. It also insists by its very style on the intellectual's essential right to freedom, imagination, and even playfulness and frivolity. His next novel, Wahdaha Shajrat al-Ruman, Only the Pomegranate Tree, which came out in his translation in English as The Corpse Washer. You can even see the different kinds of interests at play in that change of title. And his next novel, Ya Maryam, take up the next stations in the passion of Iraq. The Corpse Washer tells the story of an aspiring sculptor who gets pulled back into sectarian identity and into his father's profession of preparing corpses for burial according to Shia ritual amid the dismemberment of the country and of those corpses in Iraq's progressively horrific civil war. And his third novel, Ya Maryam, has just been nominated for the prestigious International Prize for Arabic Fiction, the so-called Arab Booker Prize. Sinan has also published two collections of poetry in Arabic and one collection in English, which I can't show you because a student borrowed it and doesn't want to give it back, called Baghdad Blues. It came out in 2007. Among all this and also co-founding the influential online magazine Jadalia, he's also found time to be really active in translating the work of others. Mahmoud Darwish is in the presence of absence from Archipelago Press, won the ALTA, American Literary Translators Association, prize in 2012 for best translation. He's also published a selection of the Iraqi poet Saadi Yusuf's late work called Nostalgia, My Enemy. And his translation of Toni Morrison's Home is forthcoming in Arabic this year. So Mabruk on all of that. And we are delighted to have him with us here today. So please join me in welcoming Sinan Antoun.
Thank you so much. Thanks. Thank you so much, Margaret, and thank you all for coming. I would like to thank Professor Margaret Litvin for inviting me to take part in this series. I'm honored to be here and delighted to have the opportunity to share with you some thoughts about my work and my experience as a translator. Despite all of this now extensive translation work, which shows my age, for some reason, I've only spoken publicly once about the practice of translation. So it's a good opportunity for me to be self-reflective and look back at my work. And I guess I should qualify that obviously it's going to be my own experience in translating Arabic poetry into English and living and working in the United States in the post-9/11 world and the era of endless wars and invasions. So the political context, maybe you can tell from the introduction, the wonderful introduction, which is so wonderful that whatever I say now is going to be a letdown almost. That I believe that the political context is inescapable and the politics of language, of Arabic in particular, and of translation are always operative, whether we like to or not and whether we're conscious or not. And when the title of this lecture was posted on a certain social media outlet, a friend of a friend posted a question about what is, admittedly, a somewhat odd title, Translation and the Work of Mourning. What could that be, she asked. I answered that one would have to attend to find out. Translation, of course, is a signifier more at home in this series and the general context, but mourning is the stranger, the intruder encroaching on an otherwise familiar terrain. So let's hope that by the end of my talk it will not be so strange or foreign. So what follows are musings on translation and on variations of mourning. I will tell a story in which translation itself is a form of extended mourning, both of individual and collective loss, and speak a little bit about the poet I'm working on recently, Sargun Bolus. My earliest memory of a striking analytical or philosophical statement about translation goes back to 1989. One sentence from a review written in Arabic by the well-known Iraqi translator Kazem Jihad of a book by Derrida stayed with me. The sentence was, quote, "Every text remains in mourning until it is translated," end of quote. What struck me back then, I was still an undergraduate student who had started writing poetry and fantasized about becoming a writer, but had only taken a translation course and never translated anything. What struck me was that language and the anthropomorphization of untranslated texts. I imagined the text wearing black and waiting in silence and sorrow for a translator to put an end to their mourning. I have tried to locate this quote in Derrida's work, but have not been successful. This was back in the pre-digital age, and the Paris-based Arabic language magazine Al Yawm Al Sabi' became defunct in 1991. Its archives have yet to be digitized, so I'm also not sure, but I did not invent the quote. I have not been able to locate the review. At any rate, I use this memory of that moment as a prelude to an important concept that I've been thinking about in my work, and that is the lives and afterlives of literary texts. In his well-known essay, which I'm sure most of you are familiar with, The Task of the Translator, Benjamin remarked that, quote, translation marks the stage of continued life. The idea of life and afterlife in works of art should be regarded with an entirely unmetaphoric objectivity. Life is not limited to organic corporeality. The concept of life is given its due only if everything that has a history of its own and is not merely the setting for history, is credited with life. In the final analysis, the range of life must be determined by history rather by nature, least of all by such tenuous factors as sensation and soul. He goes on to say, indeed, is not the continued life of works of art far easier to recognize than the continued life of animal species? The history of the great works of art tells us about their antecedents, their realization in the age of artists, their potentially eternal afterlife in succeeding generations. End of quote. Texts, then, have lives and afterlives, even eternal ones. But if they have life and are spaces where life exists, who inhabits the text themselves? The author, of course, or rather his or her memory or history, together with the living reader. The latter as a guest, perhaps, to the author as host or as ghost. The concept of the ghost is not used for mere ornament here, but I will return to its significance later. Mahmoud Darwish, one of the poets whose work I greatly admire and have translated, including the book in which he elegized himself before his death in the presence of absence, wrote beautifully about the author's afterlife in texts. He wrote, quote, "Let us go together, you and I, on two paths, you to a second life promised to you by language, in a reader who might survive the fall of a comet on Earth, and I to a rendezvous I have postponed more than once with death." So the dying author, who has only one life, addresses his other, his immortal self. Writing here promises an afterlife for the author in the original language, just as translation does in other languages. And there is a fascinating parallel to this idea in the history of the signifier tarjama in Arabic, the word for translation. In contemporary usage, of course, you know that it means translation. But in pre-modern Arabic culture, tarjama meant translation, but it also meant biography or life. To quote Dwight Reynolds in Interpreting the Self, the term encompasses three interrelated ideas: explanation or interpretation, transformation into a different medium, and that of clarification by means of division into sections and labeling. Tarjama as a biographical notice may be taken to be a representation of a person, and this is very important, to be distinguished from the physical being. It is an exact, an inexact, imperfect copy of a life, just as a commentary cannot represent the original text. So the scene and space of translation are teeming with life and afterlife here, it seems. What of mourning, then, and why bother with it? Mourning implies death, of course, and it is important to my own work in translation for multiple reasons. Two of the three poets whose work I have translated extensively, Darwish, who lived, was born in 1941 and died in 2008, and the Iraqi poet Sargun Bolus, born 1944 and died in 2007, died in recent years and within a year of each other. Thus, the act of translation, of translating them, is itself a conscious act of mourning. More importantly, however, is the poetry of mourning itself that these three poets wrote, in addition to Saadi Yusuf, who was mentioned. The mourning of individual and collective death and of the disintegration and destruction of homelands, whether Palestine or Iraq. This brings us, unfortunately, to wars, invasions, and military occupations. And I'm tired of talking about them for the last 12 years, but it's always stunning how we live in an amnesia culture where these wars, for the most part, depending on your class and background, are invisible. The effects of 9/11 and its aftermath on translations have been discussed eloquently by Emily Apter in The Contact Zone. After 9/11, she writes, quote, "Translation moved to the fore as an issue of major political and cultural significance. It took on special relevance as a matter of war and peace," end of quote. When it comes to Arabic literature, and I will repeat what Margaret said, but I think it's worth repeating, I have often thought of the general heightened interest in Arabic literature in translation, and all things Islamic for that matter, after 9/11 as forensic interest, and of translation in this case as a form of cultural interrogation. While the fortunes of modern Arabic literature in the U.S. were far from ideal before 9/11, it would not be exorbitant to count Arabic literature, and culture for that matter, as a site that suffered extensive discursive damage in terms of its reception and dissemination in translation. The Manichaean discourse deployed by the Bush administration to exploit the 9/11 attack for political reasons drew on an already resilient Orientalist archive to overdetermine and predetermine how the event and its aftermath were to be understood and which responses were appropriate and needed. Any and all knowledge about Arab or Islamic civilizational and cultural others was and still is in high demand. While no reading or translation is immune from politics and ideology, Arabic literature came to be read even more so as ethnography and or fragments of the monolithic exhibit pointing to a guilty culture that has to always absolve itself or reinforce its reputation. All of this, of course, is something that those of us who reproduce knowledge or translate knowledge that has any relationship to the Arab world or the Islamic world have to contend with. But having been someone who was also born and raised in Iraq and spent the first 23 years of my life there, but also just as a citizen who witnesses the horrendous political events that took place, mourning and its translation were in a way inevitable, instinctive, and necessary to cope with the immeasurable loss. I would say the immeasurable loss not out of nationalistic feeling, but out of the basic human, now I'm going to sound traditional and humanist, but... So the reason why I chose mourning, of course, is the immense loss in terms of Iraq. You know, while, of course, even the loss of American lives and the suffering of American soldiers is not sufficiently understood, but when it comes to civilian others, they don't register. You don't read their names. They're never counted. But to highlight why, in a way, to write poetry well about Iraq after everything that has happened, one has to give you a few details. Something similar applies, I think, in the Palestinian case. Mahmoud Darwish once wrote, you know, it's difficult to be a Palestinian poet because of all the tensions and the pressures and the traps of nostalgia or facile nationalism and all of that. The human toll and the magnitude of material destruction visited and unleashed by the occupation of Iraq, even though it's over, but it's not really over, because when the soldiers come back, the effects of wars stay on for generations. It's difficult, if not impossible, to measure for various reasons, but even the most conservative estimates are quite horrific. In addition to hundreds of thousands of lives lost, 250,000 in the most conservative estimates, there are, according to the UNHCR, some 4.5 million refugees in Jordan, Turkey, and Syria. And of course, those in Syria now have been displaced because we have the double displacement of Iraqi and Palestinian refugees. And 1.7 million internally displaced persons. There are 4 million orphans and 1.5 million widows. This is in a population of 28 million. As staggering as these figures are, they're not surprising if one takes into consideration what the invasion and occupation entailed materially, and that is dismantling the Iraqi state and its functioning institutions and replacing it with a sectarian system whose record of dysfunction and corruption is notorious. So all of this has added new layers to an already complex and crowded history of violence with multiple villains and multitudes of victims. Of course, in mainstream media and parlance, you get the simplistic civilizational cultural explanation. It's about Islam, it's about Sunnis and about Shiites, and that's just obfuscation. We don't want to get into that now. But how does one address the dead and their absence, address them in both senses of the verb? So the relationship of the living to the dead is, of course, a political one, and itself always a contentious site. Iraq itself, many have commented, is an open mass graves. So Iraqis in general and Iraqi makers of culture in particular are haunted by the ghosts populating this mass grave. This ontology, to borrow a term from Derrida, is a crucial political as well as a literary trope. So this brings me to Sargon Bolus, whose work, to my mind, is crucial in this respect, particularly his last posthumously published collection. He has a very interesting trajectory as someone who was born in Iraq in 1944 to an Assyrian family and grew up in Kirkuk, which is a very interesting multilingual, multicultural, I hate to use this term, but that's the reality, and then left Iraq to Beirut and then settled in San Francisco. He was part of the 60s generation, part of the pioneers of modern Arabic, but he was also enamored with America and with America and what the 60s offered. But that, of course, will change later. I go back to, actually, the 1991 Gulf War, but also how that also changed his own stance vis-a-vis America. Gulf War marked the beginning of a bitter disenchantment with America. He said everything was exposed in the Gulf War, another forgotten Gulf War of 1991, which is very important if you are to understand what's happening now, is to go back to that event. It was a bloodied mirror. America had nothing more to offer as far as I was concerned, end of quote. He was so upset that he abandoned the massive project of translating 20th century American poetry into Arabic that he'd been working on for years. He started to visit Europe more frequently, especially Germany. The political aftermath of September 11th, of course, left him further alienated. In a poem entitled A Conversation with a Painter in New York After the Towers Fell, he writes, quote, "I see Rodin's fingers in all this. I see him standing at the gates of hell, pointing to an abyss from which the beasts of the future will charge, there where two towers fell and America went mad." For Bolos, freedom from political parties and ideologies never meant being depoliticized or divorcing poetry from the world. He corrected the proofs of his fifth and last collection, entitled Another Bone for the Tribe's Dogs, which I'm about to finish, on the hospital bed where he died in Berlin. His disappointment with the America he was enamored with in the 60s and 70s is evident in the pages of the book. "Where is it," he writes, "where is the America for which I, the dreamer, crossed the sea? Will Whitman's America remain ink on paper?" The end of the line is a recurring image in this collection. It repeatedly suggests both the end of progress and the beginning of some sort of nightmare. Bolos' poetic discourse was always populated by alienated humans searching for a niche of meaning in an aggressive universe punctuated at times by beauty and calm. The heart of an ailing world is at once pierced and sutured on many a page. In his late work, however, there is more puncturing and less suturing, more darkness and horror. History's ghosts crowd the background, haunting the poet, who seems endlessly perplexed by the purpose of existence. Lines interrupt each other and questions posed go unanswered. But what complicates issues in Iraq is that the dismantling of the state means there is no official memory in a way. And as much as one, I am against official memories, but it presents us with a very unique situation where the nation does not have official mechanisms to organize memory and to archive the nation's history. So it's like someone who is brain dead in a way. And that's a very unique situation because the state was dismantled, but nothing was built in its place. The Iraqi Ministry of Culture is a sham. The educational system is a sham. Now, how does he deal with all of this and all of these complexities? I'll give examples from telling examples, I think. The opening short but telling poem in the collection throws us into the main theme. You have it on your handout as number one. "My grandfather's chair is still rocking over Uruk's walls. The river passes below. In it, the living and the dead toss and turn." So in the first line of the poem, the grandfather's chair seems to establish a familiar domestic space of tranquility and an intimate, continuous rhythm, still rocking. But this is put at risk in the third line, over Uruk's walls. The walls of Uruk, the first city built by Gilgamesh in mythology and by its hungry inhabitants in Bolos' other poems in the collection. This is where he differs in the way he deploys history and mythology. Are not very steady walls and lack permanence. Uruk is the city repeatedly attacked and destroyed by invaders, but its walls rise again every time. Now the chair's survival is made more fragile, as if it is about to fall. What makes the poem more haunting is that we are not told if the grandfather is there or not. The second section further complicates the poetic narrative. The scene from the vantage point of the chair and the perspective of potential stories to be narrated is that of a river. What is striking, however, is that both the dead and the living are in it. The dead are not entirely gone, and the living struggle side by side with the dead and within the same space and trajectory. The course of the river of the living and the dead is an important trajectory in the whole collection. It's important to note that the book opens with this image and closes with the very same image, but with a slight change. The last section of the last poem is entitled "My Bamboo Chair" revisits this image. You have it in number 2 on your handout. The chair rocks, the one I was sitting in just a while ago, at the edge of the abyss. My grandfather's chair, which faces the window, rocks. It rocks over Uruk's walls, rocks even when empty, no one sitting there. So now my grandfather's chair is facing a window, a sign of a concrete part of an interior and a more stable space, but it's still at the edge of the abyss, over Uruk's walls, and it is an empty chair. The river is no more. It is as if the poet was sitting in the chair and narrating, and the river running under the chair and Uruk's walls, real and imaginary, runs through the collection, and the ghosts of the dead appear in many poems, and hence the term ontology. So example number three, my open notebook under my eyes is a trap for the souls of my dead. They pass on its pages in a flicker. I hear like my first language inside any past that will not let the hero sleep. He who knows he will not be Gilgamesh. He who refuses the task. This nocturnal page is enough for him to walk to the end of the dream with a million refugees clinging to his steps. With gazing at the river of the dead and the living comes, of course, the anxiety about how to represent all of this adequately. So in example number 4, I am the one, he says, who's unfit for arranging elegies. Even though my dead are many and their graves are scattered in the wilderness, rummaged by wolves. In many of the poems, there is an intertwining of death and life, as if humans are already born dead and their elegy is being weaved as soon as their umbilical cord is severed. So example number 5, the umbilical cord is severed and the cord of elegies extends. What became of Umm Yusuf, the midwife? How many crying children did her hands pull? From the warm darkness of the womb to the nakedness of this world, to go and be lost in the valleys of their fate, soldiers fighting in lost, unjust wars. Two representative poems where the primary figure is a ghost represent encounters with victims of two monumental events or epochs and two different experiences, war and sanctions. This is another very important event that has been erased from mainstream history. You know, sanctions imposed on Iraq that were supposed to weaken the Iraqi regime but ended up killing 1 million Iraqi civilians. What do these ghosts want from the poet or from us as readers, and what is their function? The poet does not offer clear answers, but one could speculate. In both encounters, the ghosts do not have specific demands, and their only desire appears to be to narrate, to speak of their fate, or to be recognized. So we read in The Child of War, number 6 on your handout, which is dedicated to an Iraqi child who was born during the war and died in it. The child came, the one missing in the war. She stands at the end of the hallway, a candle in her hand. I see her whenever I wake up from sleep at the first hour of dawn. She waits for my collision with the wall of reality. Her eyes, vast because of the horror of wisdom, are patient in the hill's thorns, where my thoughts look around at night. My hand, which could break her chains, my voice, which might pose questions to the murderer or to God, whose answers she knows. How long has this war gone on, child? How many nights at the bottom of which well? What eternity of pain coming from all directions? What would the 4-star general have done had they deprived his child of her milk for one day? The child says, they took my family in a ship to the other world. I always knew that they would leave me here alone on the shore. I knew. So the child is trapped in between this world and the other and was abandoned. Missing in the war tells us that she has not had a proper burial, perhaps, and her death was not recognized and enframed through proper rituals. The narrator of the poem is repeatedly haunted by her. I see her whenever I wake up. The unreal ghost is what anchors the narrator's waking moments and his collision with the real. She lives with him. The sentence, my hands could break the chain, is left suspended with no answer or further knowledge. The narrator seems immobilized by the presence of the ghost, but he has his voice and poses important questions whose answers she already knows. In turn, she does not answer his questions directly, but begins to tell her simple, haunting story about abandonment, and the poem ends in an incomplete sentence. The second ghost poem is entitled, I Come to You from There, which is number 7, and is dedicated to a well-known Iraqi short story writer who died also during the sanctions in 1993. The end of the year, the year of endings, the climate and the crows, a tightness in my breathing, from smoking too much, some illness, loneliness, worrying, or visceral pain, knocked me down and I roamed the empty town and crossed over to that particular corner where he met me face to face just before nightfall. 'Twas my friend, the short story writer himself, but something had emptied his eyes of that light. It was my humorous old friend himself, but something had overturned his features from the inside. The eyebrows are white, teeth black. When he smiles, not out of happiness, he looks like he's crying. Beyond sadness, as if in an undeveloped photograph, as if in a burning photograph, which would collapse with a simple blow. He met me as we were getting out of a storm that had started yesterday. Whipping walls with restaurant and shop signs, making telephone cables weep in that empty square. I cried, Yusuf, Yusuf, what happened to your face? Yusuf, what have they done to your eyes? By God, what have they done to your eyes? He said, please don't ask. He said, it's obliteration. He said, I came from there. He said, not me. No, I'm not myself. Not you. No, you are not yourself. They and the gods of Zakum, they and the master of death standing at the door. The refugees are on the roads, the children are in coffins, the women are wailing in the squares. Your family is fine. They send you their best from cemeteries. Baghdad is a spike of grain covered with locusts. I came to you from there. It is obliteration, he said. Walked away and disappeared everywhere. The difficulty or impossibility of recognizing what used to be familiar and of fully representing what has become is viscerally clear. The theme is another major one in the collection. Bolus attempts to reach that impossible beyond of the real in its totality, but the most productive and effective instrument is still ontology. The most crucial and haunting line is the last one. He walked away and disappeared everywhere. The figure does not return to Iraq or to the grave, but continues to roam and haunt, to keep delivering messages such as these about the living dead and the dead living. Most of the figures in Bolus's last collection are archetypes of either dead or displaced Iraqis. One can read these poems as a model for an ethics of mourning and remembering. Memory is not mobilized for a concrete political objective or a cynical end. There is no demand for vengeance or retribution. What takes place is an encounter with the ghost of the past, whose only demand is to be recognized and listened to, not to have their narrative or absence forgotten or appropriated. They do not demand to be spoken for, but spoken to. Unlike their status in the dominant political discourse in Iraq, they are not a political commodity. Not speaking for the ghosts, but preserving their narratives and monumentalizing them, but without constructing an edifice, seems to be the desire running through these poems. History is confronted with all of its unsavory details. While the invasion and destruction of the nation's real and figurative walls is chronicled and mourned, there is always a recognition of the violence and bloodshed involved in building these very walls of the nation and all of its political frames. The question and challenge is how to, and is it at all possible, to sketch a new portrait and frame of all of these contradictions. Intimately linked to this is to learn to live with the dead and with the past rather than deny it, and to speak to and not for its ghosts instead of attempting to exorcise or exploit them. I will end with a poem that's not on the handout. Iraq's children are in the swings of death, rocked by the hand of the dragon coming to drink the black gold springing from the earth's heart. A rattle fills the night's throat, a night in which the murdered will not rise to point with their fingers to the murderer. Listen, here is some news. Cities filling up with the patience of widows, mourning, streets full of funerals. Did they go finally to sleep and cover themselves with dust? The last point I want to add is that, to my mind, and this is linked to Benjamin's important points in his thesis on the philosophy of history, is that history is obviously written by the victors. And then the challenge is how to capture the history or a glimpse of the history of the victims who are silenced and erased from history. And to my mind, what Bolus is trying to do in these poems, perhaps unconsciously, is to somehow be able to, and again, even as a poet, not to reduce poetry to its function as a historical narrative, but history and politics and all of that exist. In his poetry, one can see the inscription of a narrative that at once saves the lives and the memories that are completely erased in other fields and discourses, but still maintain a certain critical stance that doesn't reproduce vulgar nationalism and so on and so forth. And that's why I'm very interested in his poetry. And I should also add that the translation is spontaneous, that I start translating poems that I love, and then I try to understand why do I love them so much and why do they speak to me. And hence the translation and the work of mourning in multiple levels of mourning the poets who died, some of whom I knew personally, but also translating the way they mourn the lives that are erased and lost forever as a way to cope and engage with the loss in a critical and radical way and not in a passive way. And I will stop here and look forward to your questions. Thank you. And comments.
Hi. I really loved your insight about poetry demanding to be spoken to versus being spoken for when in translation. Can you talk a little bit more about whether that guided you in the beginning, like when you first started translating all the way until now, or was that something that came along kind of more recently in terms of guiding how you yourself translate poems?
I don't know. Perhaps it's a fortune or misfortune to, I always jokingly say, you know, growing up under a dictatorship is a horrible thing, but you learn a few things. So all of the things that I read later about culture and politics, I had already experienced them intuitively. By living in a dictatorship, you realize how there is an official discourse that's disseminated and that silences and erases people, and people who are frowned upon disappear, just like in Kundera's novel, and now in North Korea, I guess, or in China. People disappear from. So at a very young age, I already was very sensitive to the ease with which human beings' voices and experiences can be completely eliminated. So I was haunted by that without even reading any, you know, intellectual stuff. It just sounded intuitive that someone has to, you know, bring those voices back. And that's why the first novel is about a political prisoner who whose voice and his life experience, you know, disappears in the bureaucracy, and he wants to write back. So, but I think a lot of it was heightened, somewhat like Sargon Bolus, if I may say, those of us who grow up in the misfortunate global south also have some occidentalized ideas about what America is and what it can do. And then we come and, you know, discover the great opportunities, but discover the limitations. And it's quite frustrating because it's just more subtle in a way. And that here, too, there are things that are unsayable, or you can only say them in certain places. And hence, you feel how a citizen or a group of citizens' voices and experiences, whether because of class or gender or race or history, are, for all intents and purposes, erased. They don't exist. I mean, that's Judith Butler's book, The Frames of War, is, you know, about grieving and how certain lives are ungrievable. You know, think of the drones, I mean, as we speak. This, so I think maybe the seed was there, but I must say that because of the wars and the invasions, because I feel I am in Rome, basically. I am in Rome. This is Rome. And there are people out there far away that are dispatched to death. Sometimes we grieve for them, but most of us think, well, this is how it has to be done. So it's just also the horror of being here, frankly, and being inside this machine and not being able to get out. So it's really terrible. It's depressing to listen to me. Not reality is not depressing.
So writing this then in America and translating these poems, who do you see as your audience, and sort of how do you shape your translations in relation to your audience?
You know, we're a minority. There is a minority of people all over the world who are interested in literature and translation. And I think in this country, you all know it's much worse than Europe. You know, it's the 3%. So, frankly, I've reached a very good space in terms of writing and translation where I really don't think of the audience. I just think of the text. I used to be, when I was younger, I was too really dying to be published. And I guess it's easier to say after one gets published that it's not a big deal. But really that a lot of times I write or translate something and don't publish it for 6 or 7 months, because a lot of times, actually, it was the pleasure of sharing this with friends who don't read Arabic that I, you know, I just wanted to share this with them. So, but now, nowadays, thankfully, we have more outlets than 10 years ago. And part of why I co-founded this Jedaliyah is to actually have a space for works, translations because the mainstream journals, literary journals, are very, you know, I've sent a lot of poems to the New Yorker, like everyone else, I guess, in translation, and they don't publish them. And they can't all be bad. But I'm sure they don't even look at them. They just have a card that they sent or the formulaic email. But we live in an island. I mean, in Europe, the situation is much better for Arabic literature and foreign literature. In Germany, the foreign translation is almost 50%, I think. In this country, it's 3%. The quota for translations is 3%. At an age where, you know, every 3 minutes we hear about how great globalization is and how we live in a little village, in a huge village, but we're actually getting less exposure. And as I said, it's a double-edged sword, because after 9/11, it's a type of ridiculous exposure.
I guess I have two. One's a content, simple question. Does he at all allude to the first elegy, which is Gilgamesh's elegy for Enkidu in the middle of the poem? Is that part of does he do that at all?
Part of a different poem, not this one. He alludes a lot. What I like about him is that, you know, he's an Assyrian, so in a way, in this traditional discourse, he has more right than anyone else to claim all of this. But he claims or uses all of this not in a nationalistic way, nor in an ethnocentric way. but to show actually how violence structures all political formations and all cities. But he uses Gilgamesh a lot in the other poetry, always, throughout his career.
The second one was, let's say in the first one, could you talk a little bit about the, I don't know, the nitty-gritty of the translation? Are the line breaks similar? What kinds of things did you encounter in the Arabic that you were working with? I just would like to hear a...
I think this is where his work on English and being outside for so long affects that his syntax is slightly different. And I try to maintain that in the line breaks and have fights a lot with editors when I used to translate for certain journals where the editors don't know Arabic and they insist on domesticating the poem. So the good thing about this Jedaliya, where I'm the editor, is I put the line breaks whichever way I want. So, you know, that's always the challenge, whether to try to maintain the sense, the foreignness that's there, that's intended. Because what's stunning about him is that his diction is rather simple, actually. And he's, you know, it's everything is economized. He doesn't use traditional Arabic balagha or rhetoric. So he's ascetic in that sense. And that's what I really like. But the line breaks are odd sounding, even in Arabic, especially in this last collection. But I felt that that was obviously intended, or forget the intention. The effect was desired.
I encountered the same thing in translating Amichai.
Yes.
Where it gets normalized.
Yes.
And he knows about line breaks. And so it's the same sort of issue.
No, and sometimes with some editors, they, you know, I mean, not the Sargun, but another poem has, you know, all these wild metaphors, and the editor tells me, "Oh, that is not logical." And I'm said, "This is a poem." I mean, so using a verb for this sense, for another sense, a hearing for colors, I'm like, "That's poetry. That's it. That's the whole idea of renewing language, right?" But I mean, that's another problem, of course, the editors in the publishing houses and their own. We didn't get to talk about that. But it's the predominantly the attempt to domesticate Arabic literature and to make, you know, Arabic literature sound like or read like an American novel, which defeats the purpose. So it's this filtering and cleansing.
Do you think you often have to change your metaphors to fit the English language, or would you keep the same metaphors and have the reader try to understand it?
I try as much as possible, but sometimes it doesn't work, and I abandon that. My colleague at NYU, who's a very experienced translator from French and German, Richard Seaborth, who says that translation is like war, in that... Which I like that. No, in that you have, you know, you have losses and you have gains, and you have to learn what to sacrifice and what to do in order. I mean, it's horrible after everything I said about war, that we use war metaphors. But sometimes, you know, some things are untranslatable. Certain metaphors just don't work, or I cannot find the English that is satisfying, and that's why there's a number of many poems that I translated, and halfway through or towards the end, I realized that it's not gonna work. I mean, I haven't read. I thought Emily Apter's is against world literature, but there's something about that. Some things are untranslatable in a way. Or in the book, she says everything is translatable and everything is untranslatable. So whichever depends on the mood.
Hi, I just had a question about whether you were like influenced by the works that you've translated in the works that you've actually written, like Ijam, which is the book we read for Litvin's class. And I, because just like looking through this poetry, I was kind of struck by, like, in your book, you talk a lot about like walls, kind of as a metaphor, like for memory and like for kind of like preserving memory. Like, for example, your character, like, very consciously, you know, make sure he like hangs this memory on the wall of his memory and not just on the wall of his room. And I was just wondering if you were influenced at all by any of the poetry that you've translated, because I've noticed that walls and the theme of like the interiority of memory
if you
back then I hadn't translated that much, so I was influenced by the poetry I was reading. You know, because I wrote this novel in the mid 90s, and so not really. But these guys, I should have added also that I read something that Sargun Bolus himself wrote that is taken from an advice that Ezra Pound gave to Merwin when he visited him, that he should always translate. And in a way, so a lot of times I translate when I cannot write, because I think it's one, also translate these writers that I love, because I internalize their own music, and definitely it comes out in my own writing. So Darwish or Bolus or Saadi Yusuf, according to some, comes out in some of the writings. But back then it was not translation, but of course things that I had read, and you were going to laugh, but Pink Floyd, The Wall. Okay. The Wall was very big in Iraq for obvious reasons. Big everywhere in the world, but this idea of, you know, being imprisoned and things like that. Thank you all for coming, and thank you, Margaret.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Iraqi-born novelist and literary translator Sinan Antoun. Professor Antoun's lecture was titled Translation and the Work of Mourning, and was presented by the Boston University Department of Modern Languages and Comparative Literature and the College of Arts and Sciences. Tonight's moderator was Department of Modern Languages and Comparative Literature Assistant Professor Margaret Litvin. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Marquise Neal. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.